You're listening to the Ready, Set, Cloud podcast, a show about trending and difficult topics on serverless and in the cloud. Today, we're going to talk about math. Wait, don't skip this episode yet. It's not what you think. I brought Jeremiah Dunham on the show to explain automated reasoning, a deterministic way to prove the correctness in your code using math. Sounds intense, right? You're going to love it. Ready, set, let's go. When I was in college, I was told over and over again that programmers use math all the time and that I needed to make sure I could do calculus and understand advanced theorems so I could apply them on a regular basis. After I graduated and got into software development, I realized that was a lie. Throughout my software career, I might have used algebra one time. As an app dev, I've never really had the need to do anything mathematically crazy. And this begs the question, why are we taught that math is a big part of development? I brought Jeremiah Dunham on the show to answer this question and probably confuse me with some smart guy stuff. Jeremiah, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Alan.
So you're a senior dev manager at AWS in the IAM Access Analyzer team, and you have had a fascinating career. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got here?
So I got my bachelor's in math, and kind of as you were alluding to, I was pretty much allergic to anything that looked applied. And well, fairly quickly, I figured out that I needed to do something applied in order to get a job and be out in the industry. And so that kind of led me to software development, computer science. After being a dev and a dev manager for many years, I did a brief stint as a solutions architecture manager. That's how you and I originally met. And then came back into software development on the IAM Access Analyzer team, mainly because they were doing something really interesting with kind of applied theoretical math, which I thought was super cool. So that's how I got to where I am today.
There's a lot unsaid there. You used to live in Alaska. You've moved all around the country. I know you do flights back and forth from East Coast to West Coast all the time. You live a crazy life. And something you said, I want to make sure that I elaborate on. You were the person that introduced me to AWS years ago. You led an immersion for one of my teams. And honestly, you were the one that got me interested in serverless in the first place. So for that, thank you. We're here right now because of the work that you did 6 years ago. So yeah. Thank you for that.
It was a fun time, man. We had a really fun project we worked on together. And yeah, I was happy that everybody in that group really enjoyed the experience and took to the technology.
Me too. It was a lot of fun. So, you know, I want to get into math, but I'm going to have to ease into it. I'm not about to ask you about applied advanced math. I will ask you eventually, but we got to start easy. Like, how much math am I actually doing when I'm building an app? Is it like secretly being done for me, or is it something that I might be just overlooking and glossing over?
That's a tricky one. I mean, at a fundamental level, everything we do comes down to binary, right? And so I guess at some level, translating everything is just an abstraction on top of binary. So if you look at it from that perspective, I mean, even just changing number bases, creating abstractions like text represented as numbers, images represented as numbers, like all of those things involve a whole lot of math. Even if you start at the very, very fundamental level of computing, right? Yes, there's a whole lot being done for you. And I think really that is, as we've learned over time, you know, making better and better abstractions that make it easier for humans to express themselves and taking away some of that lower level mathematical detail is where we get huge productivity gains and huge gains in creativity and all kinds of things. I know you spend a lot of time and energy on serverless. I mean, serverless is just another abstraction, right? On top of a lot of lower level like computing and networking primitives and stuff like that.
Yep, totally agree. Now, here's the interesting question for me. Like when I was thinking about the stigmas that came out of college, it's like, I totally agree that a lot of this math is completely abstracted away. And, you know, I get the privilege of using SDKs that do it all for me and give meaningful names to tasks that, you know, perform a whole bunch of math. So why is it that we're still talking about math as a core software engineering skill.
I think a lot of folks maybe know Joel on software, Joel Spolsky, right? Had a very famous like blog for years and years and years. One of the things he liked to talk about was the law of leaky abstractions. What he said was that any abstraction that we make as software folks, like at some point leaks, meaning it's not perfect, right? There is still something happening under the covers. We're interacting with the abstraction, but every once in a while that abstraction doesn't quite work the way we need it to, or it fails us in some way. And so it's for those moments when you have to get beneath the abstraction, right? When you have to go another layer down, that's when really understanding kind of the underlying technology, the underlying science, math, whichever part of it becomes essential. As there are advances in technology and in the science and the math, those things end up making their way into conventional application development, software development over time. And so somebody has to make those advances. Maybe it isn't for every practitioner, every software engineer, but certainly for a lot of folks.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. The people who are doing advanced math and building abstractions on that, like who is that? Is that service developers? Because I'm sure there are application developers out there as well that are doing it, but who primarily are the teams doing this kind of work?
Where I'm at, we do a lot of work with folks we call applied scientists. And applied scientists can truly be anyone, right, with any background and any level of experience. But often those tend to be folks who have extensive academic background, either have PhDs or have done research in math or in computer science. And that tends to be a lot of people who do kind of the underlying, hey, let's turn the math into something useful, right? And then once they create some innovation, then that gets handed over to an engineering team for commercialization purposes, right? Like cool. Now let's take this cool, innovative thing, this new capability that the scientists made and turn that into, a product, like apply it to some actual real world use cases that, you know, that people need.
Let's talk about a specific example of that, because I like the theory. And I understand the theory, I think. And it's never really until you get a practical example of theory where you truly understand it. So let's talk about some of the math and some of the work that your team does on the Access Analyzer team. Like how are you guys innovating in this math space and applying that pragmatically?
We can start with probably an example. Anybody who uses AWS probably knows this reference. There's a feature that we have called Block Public Access. And this is something that started with S3, right? Effectively, what you're trying to do in this case is you have engineers, whether they be security engineers or developers, can author IAM policies, right? So they can author policies that determine who can have access to the data in an S3 bucket. And IAM policy language is very expressive and very powerful. But with all that power means it's possible to make mistakes. And sometimes those mistakes are really, really subtle because we have things like conditions and other logical statements that you can put in your policies to say, well, only do this thing if all these conditions are met. But your ability to reason through all of the conditions to say, okay, like, does this actually work for all the situations that I think it should work for is, well, you know, humans are pretty good at reasoning about things, but not always perfect. It is possible to make mistakes. Well, with S3 Block Public Access, the idea was we want to try and detect if the person might have made a mistake in authoring the policy and protect them from a mistake. The way that we do that is we actually evaluate the policy and ask the question, does this policy attempt to grant access to somebody external? And truly, the way we define it is untrusted access. In order to do that, we apply a technique which is referred to as automated reasoning. So think about it, right? It's like a replacement for the human reasoning. What it does is we're in real time kind of constructing like a mathematical proof. So we'll say, let's look at this AM policy and let's ask about a property. So in this case, public access. And we say, does this property hold for this particular policy? And then we construct a mathematical proof and we show either no, unequivocally, that property does not hold, meaning it does not grant public access, or we say, oh, actually, there is a chance that it does, in which case, you know, oops. And so this is probably like the most famous example, identifying public access and alerting customers to that so they can update their policies is one of the key features that Access Analyzer enables.
I'm trying to figure out how that maps to math. Because in my head, what you described is an algorithm. I could very, very easily picture that as code, what you've described, and not so much in like the numbers perspective, what I think of when I think of math. So how is that different? Like where is my thought process off here?
In this case, could you turn it into code? Sure. But doing so would actually be, it would be pretty hard. Within automated reasoning, effectively what we're trying to do is translate a particular problem into a logic problem. And once we do that, then we can say, okay, cool. Now we can use a set of standardized tools that are very good at evaluating the logic problem. And part of the reason that this is important is this whole space of, is this possible or is this not possible? Like this kind of computation that we're doing falls into the computationally hard space. And so you could write an algorithm, but your algorithm is probably not good at dealing with computationally hard problems because, right, kind of by definition, they can take a long time to solve. Translating this into a lower level logic problem and then applying these specialized tools, which are very highly optimized to quickly find the answers to computationally hard problems, is a better approach.
Okay. I still have to dig in a little bit. I mean, I understand that was a great explanation, and I still have to figure out like what is the actual tangible asset that your teams are producing that do this? Is it code? Like I don't understand. Like what is your team delivering that does these things?
Yeah. So I mean, at its core, we deliver services, right? Of course, we're Amazon, Amazon Web Services. But behind the service is code that effectively takes the original policy and the problem, right? The thing that you're trying to assess translates that into a logic statement and then hands it off to this like specialized class of program called a solver, which then can quickly solve the logic statement. So there is definitely code there, but that is mostly focused on like, how do we get an accurate encoding of the policy, the problem, right? All of these things. We actually have this is kind of a weird thing. I'll say weird as in most people don't think about it this way. But if you look at what you're doing with software testing, you're trying to validate that your software is performing correctly. We don't quite refer to what we're doing as testing, but we think a lot about correctness or soundness, which is like, do we know that what we're doing from a mathematical, logical perspective is correct? Have we reasoned about this soundly? We want the bar for introducing bugs to be way, way higher because if we introduce a bug, it could have security implications for people.
Okay, so that helps. Let me turn this conversation a little bit because some of the ways that you described this math, it sounds almost like machine learning or AI, like a good fit for it. But that's not really what you're doing, right? It's not using machines to do that. Can you talk about why not? To me, if I was trying to tackle this on my own, granted, I don't have an advanced math degree, but if I was trying to tackle it on my own, I absolutely would try to feed some of these things as training to a model and hand off some of these problems to something that's been trained on things that I don't have time to actually learn and understand. Why is it that you guys are building it yourself instead of leaning on something like AI?
It's the way that I like to distinguish the two, AI from the technique that we use, which is called automated reasoning. So it's funny, we sometimes say AR, not to be confused with AI. They sound similar, nice, but they're not. It really is, AI at its core is probabilistic.
Okay, let's define that. Let's define probabilistic.
Meaning AI will basically tell you, well, based on my model and based on this input that you gave me, I compute some probability, right? I try to match what you fed me with some probability to a particular categorization or something, right? And so
Okay.
the AI will say, I believe with some percent of confidence that this is what this is. Like if you're doing like image recognition, the AI will actually tell you, I have like with 92% confidence, this is a dog in this picture. It's kind of probability, like at its core.
Okay. Yep.
And so that's great. And turns out a lot of the time the AI is right. And that's really useful because when you're talking about, like you're saying, really hard things, you don't have time to dig into the underlying thing, or maybe there is some level of subjectivity in the answer. A probabilistic answer is great. It's going to get you correct answers most of the time, and maybe even very, very, very most of the time, right? Like almost all the time, which is awesome. But there are some kinds of problems for which a right answer most of the time is not acceptable. And that would be things like security, cases where human life might be at stake because of what the software does. Basically, anything where the cost of a failure is very, very high, then at least at the current state of the art, artificial intelligence is not a good solution. But in those instances, because our focus is, you know, mathematical proof, correctness, like rigorously proven, that's why automated reasoning tends to be a good choice for those kinds of things. The most visible early example of using automated reasoning in the industry was at Intel. When they released the first Pentium chip, something like 1994, a researcher discovered that there was a bug in the chip's floating point division calculation. Okay, so pretty like low level operation that gets applied all the time. Because of the discovery of that bug, Intel had to put a liability on its books of like several hundred million dollars because they were potentially going to have to recall every single Pentium chip that they had produced and shipped. And one of the earliest applications of automated reasoning was basically to create a mathematical model for how the software on the chip was supposed to perform that demonstrated, oh, the way it has been implemented, it definitely doesn't perform that way. It has this issue. And then to go fix that and then use the math to prove, yes, now we have an accurate fix. So you can see, right? The cost of a bug, the cost of a failure for Intel was potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. And you can imagine that, you know, there's lots of other software for which the same would be true.
Wow. Yeah, that certainly makes a very good case for automated reasoning. And let me ask you a question. So we talked about AI being probabilistic. So are we saying that automated reasoning is deterministic?
Yeah.
Would that be the opposite side of that coin? Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
How can you know, or can you know with 100% certainty that what you've come up with will always be correct?
This is the challenge. Because of course, you know, if you're talking about verifying or proving things, just because we've proven that there are no bugs in a particular piece of code that we wrote, well, that doesn't mean that the code that our code depends on doesn't have bugs in it, and so on, right? All the way down the stack until you get to the chip. Although we know that Intel invests in this stuff, so pretty unlikely that the chips have bugs in them anymore. Because there is this challenge, how do you know that what you're doing is 100% correct? Of course, the answer is you don't. But what you're trying to do is minimize the risk of an error by applying these techniques. And really what we figured out as kind of a profession is that if you're going to apply automated reasoning to something, you're relying on the fact that writing the code is actually error prone, but writing a specification for what the code should do is much easier. So as long as we're good at writing the specification, which is easier, hey, this code should A, B, and C, this code should not D, E, and F. As long as that specification is written in a sound or bug-free way, then you can guarantee that the code conforms to that specification and minimize the chance of errors.
Okay. I sound apprehensive to say okay, because you're starting to get into you're starting to get into an area where you're going over my head. Like, I'm trying to reason everything that you're saying. And I guess there is a reason why we consider everything that you're talking about to be very complex. It's not something that you can just dive into and expect to be an expert in. There's a lot to it. There's a lot to it. And thinking about it the way you were just explaining it is really what's throwing me for a loop. It's not so much about what you're writing so much as how you're defining the requirements. Is that an okay way to summarize what you said?
Let's try this. I think this will
Okay.
be, hopefully this will clarify things and make it a lot more accessible. Most software developers nowadays, at least I hope almost all of them, will be writing some kind of automated tests, right? You'll write unit tests, integration tests, things like this. What you're trying to do when you write a unit test is a form of specification. You're saying, this function, when I pass in this input, should return this output. This function should reject this kind of input. Okay, so you're writing all these things. Those are effectively specifications. You're saying, hey, I'm going to say this is the behavior that I expect this function to perform. Okay, now imagine you could write that specification in such a way, or imagine you had a unit test that could actually test every possible condition. Okay?
Okay, I'm with you.
When you write a unit test, you're saying, hey, I'm going to test, like, I don't know, let's say your function accepts integers and you're like, I'm going to test 0, negative 1, and 10, and a million, or some range of values.
Yeah. Individual units. Yep.
Exactly. So the difference is, now let's say instead of just testing a range of values, you're like, okay, but let me test every possible value. And you had a unit test that could do that. That's effectively what automated reasoning is doing.
Okay.
It's basically like saying, okay, here's the spec. And it's saying for these classes of inputs, right? So you don't have to actually test every single input. It's almost like, I don't know, I guess you could think of it as like a meta input, right? It's like for this class of inputs, does this function behave correctly? And so on and so on. The way that you ultimately get your answer is math, right? The stuff that we're talking about is basically proof. One thing that's really cool, and one thing that I'm really excited about in terms of what we're doing in automated reasoning, is there's a lot of movement now to make it more accessible to developers. And so I think the greatest example of this right now is something that a lot of my colleagues have used and have worked on, is something called Daphne. So Daphne is a programming language, but it's also like, imagine you're writing code in a language where it has annotations or metadata, but those annotations are the spec. So this function should only accept these kinds of inputs, or this is a precondition to calling this function, and then this is a postcondition to calling this function. So you're making statements, assertions, basically, about how the function is supposed to behave and what the pre and post conditions are, right? Like what's the state of the system after the function executes. So looks pretty similar to like a unit test, but behind the scenes, when you run Daphne to say, okay, verify this code, what it does, it actually constructs a proof and says, okay, let me see, can I actually prove that all of these assertions hold based on examining your code? And if not, then it'll give you an error and it'll say, hey, you need to change the spec in some way, or you need to be more specific about how a certain part of your code is going to behave.
How long does something like that take to run?
Pretty quick, actually. Pretty quick.
Like milliseconds?
Probably not quite that fast. I mean, when you're talking about code evaluation, it might be like a few seconds. But when you're talking, but for a lot of our automated reasoning use cases, like the policy evaluation stuff that we were talking about earlier, almost every request to our service runs in less than a second. Considering we're doing things that are in this like computationally hard space, like it's kind of amazing. So I guess my takeaway message here is, while all of this may sound kind of cryptic and kind of weird, the tooling is getting to the point where there are lots of not super mathy developers who can use it and who can benefit from it. As the cost of adding this kind of verification to your code goes down and gets easier, then more people will do it. Where it used to be, you had to have like an Intel recalling all their chips level problem to do this stuff because the tooling was expensive and it required a lot of specialization. That cost is coming down very rapidly. So the kinds of problems that you can apply this stuff to, it's pretty much to the point of almost everyday usage now.
Thank goodness that it is becoming so reachable, because if it's not, I'm not convinced that I would use it if these levels of abstractions weren't there, because I just have a hard time fundamentally understanding a lot of this stuff. But the way that you're talking, it sounds like I should have an incredibly high level of confidence in everything that's coming out from your team, because it's deterministically proven to be correct, which is really cool.
Yeah. And like I said, the awesome thing is the tooling is becoming accessible to the point that very soon you will be able to say the same thing about the code you write. My code is also proven to be correct. And so, you know, you can sleep well at night knowing like, oh yeah, I forgot that one unit test edge case.
Is that going to fundamentally change the way we write tests for software?
So I think so. At least I would say, and not to make any like sweeping statements, I feel like there's a lot of hyperbole around, say, AI right now, right? Oh, AI is going to change everything. Not to say it won't change a lot of things, but I think kind of as an analog, I would say, I think this will make a big impact on how we test software, but I think it will be another tool in the toolkit, because I think there will still be a place for conventional testing, exactly for the reasons that we discussed, because it's possible that your spec was incorrect, or it's possible that some layer of software below your software has bugs. And so for those things, even all the proof will be inadequate. And so still good old-fashioned testing will be relevant. But I think you can move faster as a developer and with much higher confidence if you have added this level of verification to your code.
That's amazing. I should have led with that question for this whole conversation. That we could have talked this entire time about that. That's so fascinating to me. But in case somebody wants to learn more about that or understand it a little bit better, what's the best way to reach you or learn about it themselves?
If you want to connect with me on LinkedIn, that'd be awesome. And yeah, if you want to get started, like checking out a verification for your own code, I would definitely check out Daphne. That's D-A-F-N-Y, Daphne. Super cool. Like I said, there's great tutorials and pretty easy to get started.
Perfect. Okay. Well, thank you, Jeremiah. I ended up getting as confused as I thought I would during this talk, so I appreciate that. I feel like you really blew my mind with some of this stuff. So really appreciate the time. Thank you for lending your expertise, and we'll talk to you later.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Alan. It was a pleasure.
That's it for this episode of the Ready Set Cloud podcast. Thanks for joining me, and remember to follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. This is Alan Helton, and we're out of here. Yeah.